Welcome to the Cashflow Ninja, the podcast sharing how to create and grow income streams and manage, multiply, and protect your wealth in the new economy. Are you tired of trading your time for money? Do you desire freedom today instead of retirement in 10, 20, or 30 years? I'm MC Lobsher, and this is the Cashflow Ninja. This is Cashflow Ninja. I'm MC Lobsher. Thank you so much for spending your most valuable resource, your time, once again with me for another show on the Cashflow Ninja podcast. You can check out all of our past episodes of both our Cashflow Ninja podcast show and Cashflow Investing Secrets, along with community resources and much more at cashflowninja.com. There's over 700 podcasts that we've done between the show that you can enjoy. If you want to learn more about how to become your own bank and become the bank and utilize the principles that banks use to multiply their wealth, you can also check out a free video series that we've created for you, the listener and the viewer, at yourownbankingsystem.com. That's yourownbankingsystem.com. Man, those banks have something figured out. In today's show, I'm very excited to be joined by Tom Wallace, entrepreneur, startup, and angel investor in the tech space. Tom, welcome to the show.
MC, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be on your show and very excited to be with you today.
For listeners and viewers that's not familiar with you and what you do, could you please share a little bit about your background and journey with them?
Sure. I have spent my whole career in technology. I started my first company as an entrepreneur when I was 23. And I'm three decades into this and have built a bunch of companies and exited them. But along the way, I started angel investing. And that's pretty common in technology because I think technology entrepreneurs are wired to kind of help the next guy and help the next woman. And so I've been angel investing for about 25 years. And 4 years ago, I exited my last company, sold it to private equity. And I decided I wanted to do angel investing full time. So I got involved with Florida Funders. I'm the managing partner here. And me and my partners, we basically have made angel investing easy for our clients. We like to say we take all the hard work out of angel investing. And we also do a lot of educating and helping people understand how to angel invest. And then we also have our own venture capital fund that invests alongside of our angels. And we'll do 15 deals a year, roughly. It's kind of volume. We've got about 80 companies we manage right now. So that's what we do.
Fantastic. Now, we've got listeners all over the world at different parts of their journey or different stages. For folks not familiar with angel investing and what angel investing is, can you just shed a little bit of light on that for us?
Sure. It's early stage technology investing. And you might ask, different people might give you a little different definition of it. But in the tech world, angel investing is typically when a company gets started, you know, founder has an idea, they usually get some family and friends to put together some money. That may be anywhere from 20,000 or, you know, 10,000, whatever, up to a couple hundred thousand. Then they get the business so far, they get maybe a minimal viable product out, they start getting some customers. And then they typically reach out to angel investors, people like myself, who are a lot of entrepreneurs who have had exits. Sometimes they're people still running businesses. Sometimes they're just executives who have been successful. Sometimes family offices get into this space. And then we invest. And our goal at the angel stage is then to get that company to what's generally considered a Series A round, which is an institution round. So that we sit between family and friends and the institutions from venture capitalists. And that's the area that angel typically plays in. Sometimes they're pre-revenue deals where the companies don't even have revenues yet. Personally, we like to invest a little later than that. They don't necessarily have a lot of revenue, but they have a real product. They have real customers that we can talk to and interview and ask about the success of how much they like the product and that sort of thing.
So early stage investing, and you've been a founder of companies too in the technology space. So as a founder and as an early stage investor, what are some of the lessons that you've learned in that part? Because that's that's very, very early on. We always just see, you know, the much later stages, you know, when there's already, you know, Airbnb at the time of recording just went public, you know, lately. So I can imagine in the beginning when that idea was floating around, you know, it obviously didn't have that much traction or success or revenue that it had towards the later stages. So early on, people must have looked at this and go,
what are you guys going to do?
I always say that about Uber. When I first heard of Uber, and I've talked to a friend who's been on my podcast, a fellow investor, Zach Coolius out of San Francisco, because he passed on, he knew Travis Kalanick, the founder of Uber, and passed on it. I said, don't feel bad, because when I first heard the idea behind Uber, I thought it was the stupidest thing I ever heard of. I'm like, wait, some stranger's going to come in their car, pick me up at my house and take me to the airport or take me to a restaurant. Like, why would I do that? But, part of angel investing is you're not going to get them all. You're going to miss some, and sometimes the craziest things. But to answer your question, there's two parts to it. What does it take? And then as an investor, what do we look for in founders? And, two sides is kind of the same coin. But, building businesses, MC, is really, really hard work. I mean, it's like getting punched in the face every day, and you got to get up and have resiliency. You got to be a really hard worker. There's a lot of a glamour around being an entrepreneur and being the next Mark Zuckerberg or the next Elon Musk. It's really super hard work. And so we look for people with a really strong work ethic. We look for founders and entrepreneurs that have perseverance, that are going to be able to take those blows and get back up. Using Uber as an example, I think they almost went out of business like 3 times. It's never a linear, or very rarely is ever a linear road to the top. I mean, there's a lot of peaks and valleys in there. And is that founder going to have the resiliency and the perseverance to say, I'm going to be successful. I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm not going to quit. I'll figure this out. So, we look for that. Of course, we look for people we can trust. Like everybody, you surround yourself with people you trust. You want to invest in people you can trust. If somebody doesn't have integrity, if we can't believe what they're telling us, we don't want to be in business with them, and we don't want to invest in them. So there's a few of our things that we look for in founders.
Yeah, because behind the scenes, I mean, think about, it's funny that sometimes the media does a great disservice to aspiring entrepreneurs, and especially in the tech, because it's usually this very glorified story that are shared, right? Oh, these two guys, the two Steves started a business in a garage, and then all of a sudden Apple was born and, yada, 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 one of the biggest companies on the planet. But they didn't really share with you too that, if you had to meet those two guys that was building things, that they both had full-time jobs, working very long hours, then working after hours building stuff. It took many different years to build prototypes and pitch. And like you mentioned, getting punched in the face by just getting door shut, right? How many people did Steve Jobs need to talk to before somebody finally looked at this and said, maybe I'll give these guys an opportunity?
I actually use that story a lot. And, when I'm talking to fellow angel investors and trying to educate people and investors, think about this. If some 19-year-old kid came into your office, he had really long hair, he had a beard. He didn't wear shoes, didn't have shoes on. He pretty much stunk, right? And he told you, I need $500,000 and I'm going to change the world. Would you have given that kid the money? That was Steve Jobs, and that was Mark Marcola that gave the money. I mean, that's kind of the nature. One thing, because I've had investors of ours tell me, do you use the Sunday dinner rule with your founders? Like, with these people you'd want to bring home and have Sunday dinner with your family? I'm like, that's really not appropriate in tech investing. I mean, these are some really quirky people a lot of times. I don't want to, that's not what I'm looking for. The Sunday dinner rule is not part of our test here, whether we're going to invest in somebody or not.
Yeah, especially these guys. I mean, you could have someone come in with a skateboard, like you said, like Steve Jobs, not showered, shaved, quite a character.
Yeah. But we do very much look at the founders. I mean, depending on the stage we're investing in, it does vary some, but the earlier it is, the more we're looking at the founder, because the product might not even be complete. The market space might not be clearly defined. So you're really betting a lot on the jockey even more than the horse. So we do look at those founders, but again, we're looking for work ethic. We're looking for perseverance. We're looking for people that have vision. I mean, Jobs had incredible vision, and talent, all that other stuff. So my point there is, a big part of this angel investing is looking at the founder.
Is there another part of the checklist that you might be able to share? Because this is uncharted territory, because a lot of our listeners and audience know, when you throw a real estate deal in front of them, they've got to checklist that they can run through and could do some math. What are some of the other things? Obviously, the founder is huge, the jockey. What are some of the other things that you look at?
Yeah, we call this the five D's of angel investing. So the first thing is diversification. This is a low probability game. So we know when we invest in companies, we know a third to a half of those companies are going to zero. We know if you use the third rule, a third or we're going to get our money back and we're going to make all our money on the other third and probably the top half of that. So if you're going to only do one or two angel investments or three, that's not a good idea. You're probably better off going to a casino. You've got to build a portfolio of different people tell you different numbers. I, 10 to 12 minimum companies that you're investing in. Because a lot of them aren't even going to be successful. So you've got to, the ones that are should be 30, 40, 50x returns. They're going to make up for the ones that, that don't make it. That's why this asset class really can perform very well compared to other asset classes. But, this asset class should only be 5% of your net worth or lower. I mean, and you need to diversify. The second thing, deal flow. So you need to look at a lot of deals for every deal that you're going to do. Our rule of thumb here is about 50 to 1. So we look at 50 companies for every one we invest in. I talked to angel investors and I learned it's the hard way of making the mistakes. Like, how many deals did you do? I did two. How many did you look at to do the two? Two. what do you think? If we're looking at 50 to do one and you're looking at one to do one, so you got to be selective. You got to have the deal flow. Due diligence. I mean, you really got to do your homework once you're investing. So that's looking at the founder, really checking all the into their background and are they who they say they are? Have they done what they said they're going to do? And then interviewing early customers, do they love the product? Is it nice to have, a have to have? So there's a lot of industry research on this. 20 hours or more of due diligence significantly increases your probability of returns. At Florida Funders, we don't invest in anything without doing at least 80 hours of due diligence in it. The fourth one is domain expertise. So knowing something about that area you're investing. For example, if you're a doctor, you're going to invest in medical technology devices. I mean, that you're going to be pretty good at evaluating this. I have no background in medical. I don't invest in medical technology. I invest in SaaS software and cybersecurity infrastructure, stuff we know here. So if you don't have the domain expertise and you're looking at a deal that's outside, you know nothing about it, you need to find that industry expert to help you out. And that's a big part of what we do at Florida Funders too, because we have a network of 1,500 investors that we can tap into, whether it be insurance tech, ed tech, digital health. We can always find somebody that has deep domain expertise. And then the last thing is discipline. Like any investing, and I'm sure what you do, MC, you've got to have discipline. You've got to come up with that process. You've got to work these other four Ds and you got to stick to that. You can't fall off of that. And part of the discipline for us in angel investing is FOMO. Never do a deal just because your friends are doing it. You don't want to be left out. That's a really bad way to invest. And do the other four D's. Those are the good reasons to invest. Just because all your friends are doing it, you don't want to be left out, miss out on some great deal. Part of being an angel investor, you're going to miss some good deals. I mean, you're going to miss some deals that go to the moon. That's okay. That's just part of the game. But you don't want to invest for that reason. So hopefully that's helpful.
No, that's great. You definitely don't want to chase the game, as you said. And that's a mistake that a lot of investors make in any space. I just see a lot of stuff in, for example, in the blockchain cryptocurrency sphere these days. There's a lot of folks chasing certain projects right now where, as you mentioned, that's when the FOMO kicks in, the emotions take over, right?
Yeah. And it's easy to do as an investor, just like in public markets, as Warren Buffett. It always says, be greedy when others are fearful, be fearful when others are greedy. It's easy to say that, but it's a lot harder to practice it because our human psyches are kind of designed or engineered not to do that. So that's the discipline part of investing.
What is the state of tech startups and the state of investing in that space today? There's a lot of stuff happening. I mean, this year, I always say that, wow, it's like we almost like fast forwarded 10 years in like the space of 3 months in 2020, the speed of, I would say, of technology taking over and replacing a lot of stuff. And they haven't rolled out the 5G and the, all of the AI and the robotics and I mean, it's quite incredible just seeing this, where this is all going. What do you see as the state, and what are some of the exciting things happening in tech startups today?
Yeah, it's a great time to be in tech, obviously. COVID has really accelerated the tech boom that we're in. You know, so many people working virtually, so many people that have extra time on their hands, and so many industries that have changed, you know, the way we shop, the way we grocery shop, how we consume content. And it's really benefited tech companies. And it's not just the established companies that have benefited from it. Obviously, they have the Amazons of the world. But, you know, we have a bunch of companies in e-commerce that are doing very well. We have companies that do, in the virtual workspace. And none of us know what the new normal, when it's going to be and what it's going to look like, but it's obviously going to be different. You know, we're not going back 100% to everything the way it was. I think we're all aware of that. And so the companies and the entrepreneurs who can be opportunistic and take advantage of, for example, online education. I ran a company. My last exit was an online education company I ran for 13 years that we exited to private equity. I mean, online education is just blown up. And, you got all these kids now and that are taking so many of their courses online. That trend is not going to go backwards. I mean, and so, tons of opportunity. And then you brought up some technologies that just, we like to say in our business, every 10, 15 years, game-changing technology comes along that literally changes everything. Started in 1980 with a personal computer and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Microsoft and Apple were born then. Then again in 95 with the internet, and Bezos and Amazon came out of that. Then again in 2006 with the smartphone, and the cloud. So did companies like Salesforce.com and Netflix come out of that. And we're on the precipice now. We've got, and you mentioned a few of them, artificial intelligence, augmented and virtual reality, IoT, Internet of Things, blockchain, 5G, quantum computing, 3D printing. We have these massive changes all hitting us at one time. So the opportunity for investors, the next Microsofts, the next Salesforces, they're being built now. And over the next 5 to 10 years, the wealth that's going to be created by these founders and entrepreneurs and for investors is, I think, just phenomenal opportunity that's just so exciting. You mentioned artificial intelligence. I don't want to leave that one out because I think that's one of maybe the biggest of all of those.
Absolutely. That's what I always say to folks. I think right now, if you could pick any time in human history to be alive, I mean, now's a pretty good time to pick because there's game-changing technologies and the playing field is much level. And when you've seen massive shifts and changes over the period of history, you go from the agricultural age to, the industrial revolution, you kind of had to have a little bit of skin in the game, have some land, have some factories or access to that. But these days, with the access to technology and access to the internet, I mean, it's the playing field is a lot more level than what it's historically been, right?
Oh, MC, you're so right. When I started my first company in the 80s, you had to buy servers and you had to buy all these computers and all this technology and invest in all this stuff. And then the resources that were available for entrepreneurs, there were no incubators and accelerators. And now first of all, if you want to become an expert in anything, you can do it pretty much for free, right? There's so much online content available. So that part of it in and of itself, you've got all these incubators and accelerators. And then with the cloud, you don't have to buy a server. All you need is a laptop and you can have access to really all you need to build a company. You're absolutely right. There's never in human history, a better time to start a company or an easier time in a time where you don't have to raise as much money or you can wait to raise it after you've actually got, more traction, better product, further along. Anytime you can do that, you're going to end up with more ownership as the founder.
Yeah. I just even see it like at a smaller, I would almost say solopreneur level, you had to have all these different accounts and all these different vendors and subscriptions, and this has to be integrated with this. And now you literally have companies rolling out and say, well, you've got a website, you've got a sales funnel, you've got a membership. And by the way, it's all here, wrapped in one, done for you, plug and play, drag and drop, no coding. You know, it's kind of crazy how it's moved. I wanted to ask you a question about the online education, which is one of the big, big successful companies that you exited was in that space. This is just mind-blowing to see already the incredible growth that this space has achieved. What is your opinion where we're at with this? Are we just getting started? Is this taking to a next level? Will this disrupt traditional forms of education to schools, colleges, post-grad degrees, and so forth?
Yeah, I think we're early in the game. I got started in that business back in 2003. So at that point, we were going to companies and saying, hey, you should, you know, have an online university for, we were in the enterprise software business, for all your employees. And, you know, nobody had anything. So, you know, we're well beyond that. Now every major corporation has online education and has had for a while, but there's still a lot to come. And, you know, in the changes that are going to come, when you layer in augmented virtual reality, I mean, you can teach surgeons how to do surgery without ever, you know, actually doing it in real time. I mean, we're not quite there yet, but AR and VR are going to have a tremendous, I mean, think about kids learning about the pyramids when they can put on a set of virtual reality goggles and walk through the pyramids just like they're in the pyramids in Egypt. The way people learn and consume content, it's just going to be such a richer learning experience. And it's already having it's tremendous, and it's going to be cheap and ubiquitous and potentially free. I mean, you know, you can take Coursera courses today from some of the top university professors from Stanford and MIT and not pay anything for it, or pay very little for it. And so, you know, the idea of having a degree, I think, is going to be less important in the future. And if you look at areas that are going to be disrupted, I mean, higher education, what it costs, especially these small private liberal arts schools that are $60,000-$70,000 a year. And you got to go there for 4 years and you come out with this liberal arts degree. I mean, man, I wouldn't want to be in that business. If you don't really want to have the university experience and don't want to live in a dorm and you don't care about that, you just want the education side of it, they don't really have much to sell at that point. And, you know, maybe if you're one of the top 10 schools on the planet or an Ivy League school or something, you got that brand, but you know, there's a lot of universities that, you know, don't have that. And, you know, that's I think they're really going to be challenged. And then when you go to K-12, everybody knows America, we've had an education crisis going on for about 50 years, right? And, you know, you can look at all the stats on this and the kids that aren't really learning that much, spend a lot of time in the classroom, but they're not learning very much. That's what I think is really exciting. Because if you look at, if you compare online education to in-classroom education or in-person education, and there's some studies, you can Google this, they're about even as effectiveness, but when you blend the two, then you really start to get some really significant increases in retention and learning. And, you know, think about how much better of a job we could do for kids, and especially kids that are in rural America or deep inner cities that don't have access to good education. When it's all at your fingertips, you know, it really doesn't matter where you're at, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I think there's so much room for disruption. And like you said, with university, besides the college, quote unquote, experience, there's nothing that they're selling really. Unless, I mean, like you said, the brand names, they're selling a country club, right? Let's be honest. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford.
They're selling the network too, because once you go, the people coming at it. But the other thing is, my daughter went to Auburn. I'm a big college football fan. So you're also selling, there's that other brand that you're selling, that college experience of partying and going to games and, you know, that side of it. But there's a lot of schools in between that don't cover those two. So that leaves a lot of colleges that really are going to be challenged in the coming years.
Absolutely. Now, your company, what are some of the companies that you guys invest in? How do you find deals? Maybe share a little bit more of that with our listeners and viewers.
Yeah. So deal flow, how do we find deals? We call that deal flow in our business. You know, they're like in the state of Florida, you know, which we focus on Florida primarily in the Southeast. There's 45 incubators and accelerators in the state of Florida. So we're constantly interfacing with them. We have relationships with them. We're cherry picking the best and brightest companies and founders we see coming out of those places. We have a whole deal team that scours the Southeast. We do some deals outside of the Southeast too, but we focus more on, again, primarily Florida and the Southeast. we're out and about in all the tech conferences. Now they're all virtual, but we're constantly judging pitch competitions and attending these tech events and, you know, looking at founders and companies and trying to find, you know, the ones that really fit us. I mean, it's not just about, are they a good company? Are they the next, you know, Facebook? Or is this the next Mark Zuckerberg? Or is this the next Jack Dorsey? It's got to be a fit for us too, because we don't only write companies checks. We then get very involved in helping those entrepreneurs be successful. We coach and mentor them. We take a board seat. We use our connections for introductions to early stage customers. We have a person here, Candace Resvanian, who her title is Director of Founder Success, and her whole job is to help our portfolio companies be successful, to provide them with the tools they need, and to help them with resources and introductions and networking. So yeah, we're constantly out there. We get 50 to 100 people, founders a month, go to floridafunders.com, our website, just apply for funding and get in our process. So we built a brand. PitchBook named us the most active VC in the Southeast last quarter, and so did CB Insights, two industry very well-known content providers named us. You know, so we got a lot of brand out of that. So, you know, people are coming to us at this point too.
Speak to Florida, and you mentioned so Texas, I'm assuming. So Austin has become a tech hub and a lot of folks moving there. Florida is, as you mentioned, lot going on there. And maybe speak to the growth in that. And obviously there's a lot of things contributing to it. Our listeners and viewers, we've been talking about the Great Migration for a while. For many different reasons, whether it be politics, taxes, cost of living, standard of living, schools. I mean, there's many different reasons why people move from one area to another. But maybe you can speak to the growth of tech in these two regions and these two states, and why potentially it, you know, you think of tech, you think Silicon Valley, and why that perception is changing a little bit.
Yeah, it is a great migration. I mean, I think probably Elon announced last week he's moving to Texas. Tim Ferriss left the Valley. I mean, there's Peter Thiel left. I mean, there's a lot of rock star entrepreneurs that have left the Valley in San Francisco. You know, I think COVID's only exacerbated that, because, you know, people can work from anywhere now. And I think we're going to see more disparate teams in the future. So it's not, you know, one concentrated place. Obviously, California has a lot of problems. I mean, between cost of living, cost of real estate, quality of life, traffic, smog, taxes. So people are leaving California. There's a lot. It costs a lot less to start and build a company in Florida or even Texas than it does in California. And in the past, people mostly left, you know, San Francisco and Silicon Valley, and they went to either Denver, Boulder, Austin. We're seeing them come to Florida now. I mean, we've had, I don't know how many unicorns we're up to in the state of Florida, well over a dozen. Chewy.com, Nobe4, we had two last week, ShipMunk and Luminar. By the way, Luminar is a 25-year-old kid, he's now a billionaire. The founder of that, he was 16, 17 when he dropped out of Stanford to start that company. That's in Orlando. JetSmarter, Fanatics, these are all Florida companies that have become unicorns. And I'm not even mentioning all of them. So it's no longer, you know, you got to go to the Valley and you can only become the next Google if you're in the Valley or in San Francisco. You know, you can build a great company anywhere. And Snapchat's out of L.A., Microsoft did it years ago. I mean, they're always been a Seattle company. Bezos and Amazon's out of Seattle. So I think this trend is only going to continue. And again, I think COVID has accelerated it. And with the tools that we're all becoming used to, whether it be Zoom, all these other, and we actually are an investor in a company in that space, Finzetto, which actually is Zoom on steroids. So there's going to be all these ways you can work remotely. So where people live is not going to be as important. And so we think that bodes very well for Florida. I mean, we've got a great product here in that great taxes, great weather, really hip young people coming here in droves. Cost of living is super affordable. And so, you know, this trend is definitely benefiting places like Florida and Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that is also positive about the current environment is now startup companies and companies, your job market is all basically global. So you could get the best and the brightest. You don't longer have to hire just folks from Silicon Valley to work for your company. It's now all across the United States and basically the world, right?
Yeah, that's very true. We see more and more of our companies where their software development teams are a hybrid. They have some people in India or Eastern Europe, or even sometimes where we're starting to see more in Mexico and in South America. And then they have some people here, and you know, these teams are working around the clock because they're in different time zones. And we're seeing more and more of that. And I think that's a trend that's here to stay.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned, you know, there's obviously benefits for angels investors investing in companies very early on and finding that diamond in the rough, finding that next, you know, Uber Eats, Airbnb, DoorDash. I think that was the one that I was looking at. All these different companies, Uber. There's a lot of benefit, obviously, that for the multiples and the growth and so forth. And then there's a lot that angel investors bring to, for example, young entrepreneurs, you know, mentorship, guidance, their network, you know, and so forth. What does a good deal look like? If somebody's listening to this and saying, I'm looking potentially to find angel investors, what does a win-win situation look like and a deal for both parties?
A good deal looks like, I mean, in different investors would answer this. For us, a good deal looks like a company that has a big market opportunity. They can scale rapidly without needing a lot of people to do so. That's why we love the software, the SaaS software business, software as a service. Great margins, not needing a lot of capital. They're not going to have to raise a ton of capital to do it. Those are reoccurring revenue. We love subscription reoccurring revenue as opposed to project-based revenue or transactional revenue. We personally like B2B, business to business, as opposed to business to consumer, because it's what we know more. We have a lot more experience in that area, and a lot more of our investors have built businesses on that side. So that's some of the things that we look for. Now, the terms of the deal, you know, from an investor standpoint, are very important. I'm glad you brought this up. And that's something that we think at Florida Funders we're really good at, and something where we say we do all the heavy lifting for our investors, because somebody's got to negotiate the valuation. If it's an equity deal, what kind of equity is it? Is it preferred? Does it have preferences? If it's a note, what's the discount? What's the cap? And I know I'm talking a different language to some of your investors. The point is, there's a lot of nuances to investing in early stage tech. And if you're not familiar with it, it's easy to make mistakes or find that, I wish I would invest it a different way. And that's why we've spent and we focus on the space we do. And we do everything from making sure that, you know, in our agreements, when we invest with a founder, from that point forward, their compensation has to be approved by us. We're not going to put a lot of money into a company so that the founder can immediately double or triple the salary. That's not going to happen. But some founders think like that.
I've seen it on Shark Tank before. Hey, he's going to take this money and pay himself, basically.
Yeah, and part of what we educate our investors a lot, we also educate our founders, is look, investors don't give you money to put it in your pocket. That's not what we're here for. If you're at 100 million sales, then that's a different story. But early stage, you need to be putting everything back in this business. We're looking for you to earn sweat equity. You own more of this company than we do. So that's just some example. But there's a lot of nuances to drafting those legal documents and the term sheet and getting the valuation right. Because, you know, valuation's a big part of this. I mean, you know, we may love a company at a valuation of 5 million and where they're at, but if their valuation, they're telling us it's 20 million and they won't accept anything else, we may not like it so much. I mean, think about, you know, 20 million, they have to, if they exit at 100 million, we get a 5X return. At 5 million, for us to get a 5X of return, they only have to exit at 25 million. If they do the 100 million, right, we get a 25X return. So valuation is a very important part of this process too, and who we invest in.
Absolutely. Now, for folks that are interested, you guys also have a fund. What type of investors is that a good fit for? And what are some of the things that you would share with them? Obviously, we obviously know the positive side of that. What are some of the risks for them to manage? And how do they evaluate offerings such as this?
Yeah, we started out as a network of angel investors. And what happened, a bunch of our investors came to us and said, love what you guys are doing, but I don't have time to look at these deals. and evaluate them, even you, though you do all the due diligence to put it up on your portal, and I just have to click on the financial statements and projections and see it all there, and I'll still don't have time to do it, or I don't know anything about tech. I made my wealth in real estate, I made my wealth in insurance, whatever. Can I just give you the money and you invest it for me? That's how we start our first fund. We're on our second fund now. From a fund standpoint, you get built-in diversification, you know, you get built-in due diligence, you get all the things that we do for all of our other investors by default. The other thing is we do some investments just out of our fund that we don't offer to our network of angel investors. So you get some exclusivity, and that's primarily around, you know, the deal's going very fast, and to take something out to our network of angel investors takes about 60 to 90 days. And sometimes we don't have that kind of time. So our fund will just invest. Or maybe we only get a small piece of a deal, like it's a really hot deal and we can only invest 500,000. So, you know, we'll invest it from the fund and we don't get a chance to take it to our investor angel network. The downside to the fund side of it, and this is really a downside to this, one thing you have to understand, this is not a sprint. Early stage tech investing is a marathon. This is kind of 5 to 10 year investment. It's not liquid in the meantime. So you're putting your money in for 5 to 10 years, you're not going to see a return. And you have to, you know, whether it be the fund or angel investing. And by the way, we tell our founders the same thing. Like one of the questions we ask them is, so what's your plan? So, you know, when do you think you'll exit this? And, you know, they say, well, I'm going to build this in 2 or 3 years. I'm going to flip it. Then I'm going to do my next one. We're pretty much out. You know, you're commit a decade of your life to this. If you're not willing to do that, you're not really an entrepreneur. You really don't know what you're signing up for.
Absolutely. Now, one habit I've observed from wealthy and successful people is that they're always studying and learning. What are you currently studying and learning?
Oh, I love to learn and really everything. And by the way, inside and outside the technology too. So I listen to podcasts and I read Business Insight and, you know, follow the market and find, you know, see what's going on there. My favorite podcast that I listen to is Jason Calacanis's podcast on angel investing. I've had Jason on my show. He's a very knowledgeable guy in this space. His first five angel investments, one was Uber, one was Thumbtack. He had two unicorns, his first five investments. There's some luck involved there. Jason would tell you that, but I really like the guests he is on, and there are other fellow angel investors and venture capitalists. I always get to learn a lot from them.
Awesome. Now, a core message in our show is to leave our families, communities, and the world better than we found it by passing down a mindset, values, and principles to future generations, not just money. So if you cannot pass on any money to future generations and we're only allowed to pass on three principles to them to build wealth and achieve happiness and success, what would they be?
Number one would be hard work. I don't know. I know a lot of very successful people. I spent yesterday morning with a billionaire for about an hour, 2 hours talking to him. I don't know anybody that's achieved a lot of success without working hard. And if you love what you do and you have passion for what you do, it's not difficult. It's because you love it. And so find what you love, find your passion, follow that. So hard work would be one. Two is gratitude. Be grateful every day for everything you've got. Don't take anything for granted. If you want happiness in life, to me, happiness is completely tied to gratitude. And then three is mindfulness. I'm kind of a Buddhist Hindu from a philosophy, religion standpoint. And the one thing we as Americans do more than anybody, I think, is we spend a lot of time in the past with regrets. We spend a lot of time in the future worrying about what might happen. And we're not in the moment. We're not here now. And as an entrepreneur, founder, or anybody, the more you can train your mind, quiet your mind through meditation, through mindful practices, it'll make you a better business person. It'll make you a better father, a better mother, a better sister, a better brother, a better member of your community. And I think with all, as much as I love technology, the downside, and I see this a lot with the young people I'm around that are 13 and 14 and 15 years old, they're on their phone the whole time. It's like the world is passing them by. They're not living in the moment. They're living in this Snapchat, TikTok. And I'm not saying that's all negative, but go out to dinner and sit down and talk to the people you're with. Those would be the three things I would pass along: mindfulness, meditation, and gratitude.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Tom, where can folks learn more about you? Where can they follow you? And where can they stay informed of all of the many projects that you're involved with?
Yeah, thanks, MC. So floridafunders.com is our website. They can follow me on Twitter. You know, I'm on Facebook. And it's Tom at Florida Funders, Instagram. And I have a podcast. they can access that through our website and our YouTube channel.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your journey and your knowledge and providing so much value for all of my listeners and viewers. And thank you to all of our listeners and viewers out there for, again, spending your most valuable resource, your time, once again with me on the show and with Tom. Appreciate you. You can check out all of our past episodes at cashflowninja.com, along with all of our tool and resources. And if you want to learn the secrets about banking and how to use the principles, the most powerful principles on the planets that banks use, you can go to yourownbankingsystem.com. Until next time, live infinitely. This presentation is for educational and informational purposes only. The information being presented and considered does not consider your particular financial objectives or situation, and it does not make personalized recommendations. This material is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified tax and legal advisor or other qualified professionals, and you should not use the information in place of a customized consultation with a licensed professional regarding your specific personal financial objectives, situation, and needs. We believe the information provided is reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness.